Today on Against the Grain, whether it's basketball, billiards, or table tennis, sports in the U.S. are segregated by sex. And most of the time, those divisions are taken to be natural, not the result of social choices. Journalist Laura Papano asserts that sports play a key role in shaping American politics and argues for breaking down the gender wall in sports. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Sports is about so much more than athleticism and play. And as my guest today argues, it's deeply imbued with politics, as well as being a massive money-making business. And it takes as its starting point the idea that there are sex-determined differences between men and women that make men superior, ignoring the actual physical differences between athletes of different genders. Laura Papano is a journalist whose work has tracked the right-wing attacks on public education, including over trans students. Along with Eileen McDonough, she wrote the book Playing with the Boys, Why Separate is Not Equal in Sports, which we're discussing today. Laura, what is the role of sports in our society as you see it?
Sports have a monumental role. I mean, there are social, cultural, political, and economic forces that that sports have a role in. I mean, there's just no way to, in a way, escape sports. If you look at, I mean, the simple fact that the Super Bowl has become basically the only holiday we all celebrate together. It's sports, and they've long had this role. And they've, you know, we can break it out and we can look at the impact of sports and the power of sports. Sports are a key path to social, political, and economic power in the U.S. and even outside of the U.S. If we just look at, for example, you know, the political role, I mean, sports have long mattered politically. And if we look at the Olympics, are a perfect example of that, because the Olympics are not just about quote-unquote friendly competition, although that was the origin of it. They really have come down to be about these medal counts, right? These, you know, who's winning, you know, on the field. And we look at that with teams. And in America today, there's nothing more powerful than the team. And yes, athletic teams, but that ethos is kind of translated to, you know, all parts of society. And I think what's also really important to remember is historically the role that sports have played in kind of framing and defining gender roles. If we go back to the very start of modern organized sport, the idea was that, you know, sports were for men. They were about men. You know, if you look at the origins of football, I mean, football was a replacement for war. And if you look at all of the ways in which, you know, football is organized, the language that's used, it was really a replacement so that, you know, young men, when there was not a war going on, would not get soft. So the gender roles have been very, very persistent. And for women, women have always had a very conflicted role with sports, because the view was that, you know, sports were not appropriate for females because they were too manly. And because sports are gendered, it was very, very difficult early on for women to be able to play sports without lots of kind of crazy rules. If you look at, you know, dress and costumes that women used to have to wear to play tennis. I mean, I played tennis. I could not imagine wearing a floor-length gown in order to hit a ball. A lot of the things were restricted to keep women from, quote unquote, playing like men, playing like boys. And if we look at the messaging that young women have received around sports, dating back to you know, the 1930s. When I was doing some research for this book, I looked at the National Organization for Women gave me access to their historic files. And I really wanted to understand how were people not only thinking about sports for girls, but talking about them. And a lot of the connection was bound up in fertility. And the idea that women would risk this fertility if they played athletics. And in the 1930s, there was this expert in this that I came across in the National Organization for Women to Files, who argued that, quote, girls trained in physical education today may find it more difficult to attract the most worthy fathers for their children. So the challenge for young women was, how do you play sports but still be womanly and still be feminine? And that conflict has lasted for quite some time, and we saw it particularly in the 1960s, in the 1950s, and we saw it when on the one hand we saw it when women were playing sports in collegiate settings. They were often made into play days where the teams would be mixed between one school and another because the goal was not winning or competition, but the goal was to use sport for socialization and learning how to get along with other people. There's still value in that. But what I think it was important was that the message for women was that they shouldn't compete hard. And that began to change a little bit around the Olympics. So what you had is you had the U.S. absolutely dominated the Olympic Games before 1950. But then 1952, the Soviet Union joined the Olympics, and they started competing. And then suddenly, you saw in 1956 that the Soviets won 98 medals and the U.S. won 74. In 1960, Soviets won 103, the U.S. won 71. And this was just very alarming to U.S. officials. And when they started digging into it, they noticed that a big piece of the story was that U.S. females were being bested by their Soviet rivals. In the 1960 Olympics, the Soviet women won 28 medals and the U.S. women won 12. And a lot of this had to do with the messaging. In 1963, Sports Illustrated put inside a full page of a young Russian girl with auburn hair with the message, "Why can't we beat this girl?" Who the story states, who not only looks better than the girl next door, but she most certainly can run faster. And the reason, the article concludes, is that most girls, quote, will not even try. That it was considered unseemly to compete, unseemly to be athletic. There was a worry, there was anxiety about muscles. And that was somewhat tied to the anxiety about being a mannish woman. And that line of attack comes up over and over and over again. And what's interesting about that worry about muscles and about the impropriety of women competing is that you saw the echoes of it decades later when girls would participate in sports at young ages and by middle school were no longer competing. And the worry about this, is everywhere. And that's part of the cultural messaging. A 1960 New York Times headline, "Do men make passes at athletic lasses?" So what you have is you have this dichotomy that if you are going to be successful as a female in society, that gender role, then that is incompatible with athletics. Now, fortunately, a lot of people along the way, a lot of women have challenged that very successfully. And I guess one great example of that is Little League, right? Little League, was created, with boys in mind and was strictly for boys. And then you had a number of cases in which girls wanted to play and challenge that. And I guess one of the most well-known one was Maria Pepe in Hoboken, who was just a tremendously talented player. And she was on a team, and you know, there's a whole civil lawsuit that was brought by the national, by the National Organization for Women. And I was reading the testimony of that, and you know, some of the arguments were that that injury to girls would be, quote, more cosmetically damaging to a female than a male. So the idea is that girls shouldn't do this. So one of the things that we, you know, in doing this book, we really looked at, you know, the arguments and the barriers are that people thought it was immoral for girls to play sports, that they would be injured, you know, and that they were physically inferior. So those three concepts have really been a massive barrier to girls and women in athletics, and they have been for a very long time. I do think that's changing.
And we'll talk much more as we go about the history of gender segregation in sports. But I wanted to ask you, when we think about the impact of sex segregation in sports, you know, if you've just been discussing some of the examples of the way that this segregation has been in U.S. society, consistent and almost invisible, almost not notable, just as, you know, natural as anything could be. But I wanted to ask you, just stepping back for a moment, how does that history of sex segregation of sports shape discrimination outside of sports? I mean, obviously, U.S. history has been one of deeply embedded discrimination based on sex. Should we just think of sports as being an outflow of that history, or do you think sports itself has been a contributor to discrimination against women in society beyond sports?
You brought up such a, you know, a kind of key point in that there's a kind of quote unquote gender logic, right? There's a gender logic to how sports operates and how society operates. And I would argue, and we argue in the book, that one of the reasons why we need to challenge the sex segregation in sports is that that sports have been set up and arranged and created to enforce a gender hierarchy, in which the male version of any sport is superior to the female version of any sport. I mean, for a long time, until what, 2006, Olympic badminton had rules that had women's games going to 11 points and men's going to 15. There are, you know, our book is full of examples of situations in which there are differences between men and women. Women's rules or sports, the way the competitions are set up, in ways that make it impossible to compare, you know, the actual play and performance, and reinforce the notion that women just can't. Women can't play to 15 points. They can only play to 11 points. Things are shortened. They are, you know, shortened, abbreviated. There's a whole kind of history of that. That one of the things since we wrote the book in 2007 is that is starting to change, where we are now seeing, and I'll give you an example of that. So in the book, for the book back in 2006, I interviewed Margaret Murdoch, who in 1976 won an Olympic medal in riflery. And she had she and Lanny Basham tied for the gold medal. And when judges went back and looked at things, they broke the tie and gave Margaret the silver. There is some dispute about, you know, how they came to that. And I remember that Margaret was describing to me a lot of confusion among the judges, and that Margaret very much felt that it was because they did not want a female beating a male. And very interestingly, Lenny Basham, very, you know, generously and appropriately, I think, pulled Margaret up to the gold medal stand, and they stood atop there together. But what was very interesting was that in the next Olympics, men's and women's Olympic shooting was separated by gender, even though at the NCAA level, men and women compete with one another. And another interesting example of this happened a little bit later. So, you know, in 1992, skeet shooting was mixed until 1992, when Zhang Shan of China won the gold. After that, they were separated. Now there are some mixed events, but there is very much this feeling that it was not allowable for women to beat men. And what's even, and we'll get to this a little bit later, but when we talk about, you know, when we get into transgender issues, but, you know, there are some sports for which gender, and I think shooting is certainly one of them, riflery and ski shooting, where gender does not really play, and biological group sex differences don't really play a role. And yet, the rules historically were created to enforce the notion that the men's version was, quote unquote, the real version, and oh yes, over here, women could also compete. So when we look at the role of sex segregation in sport, it's that the messaging is that women are not as tough, as strong, as capable, and yet, and the translation, of course, is that women, you know, in business, in politics, in decision-making, are not as strong and tough as men. So the sports play this kind of outsized role in reinforcing these kind of this gender mythology around the particular gender sex-based characteristics, which are not necessarily even accurate.
Laura Pappano is my guest. She's a journalist and co-author of Playing with the Boys, Why Separate is Not Equal in Sports. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So it seems that the ways that sex is segregated in sports takes all sorts of different forms. There are sports where men and women both play the same sports, but the rules are different, as you've said. There are ones where they may be mixed, say couples ice skating, but then there are rules for what the woman is supposed to do versus what the man is supposed to do. How much of this huge universe of differing rules for male and female athletes, how much of it is based on custom and how much of it is legally mandated?
Well, I mean, legal is a complicated question. I mean, I know that when Title IX was first passed, there was a tremendous amount of confusion because there were some colleges that immediately started integrating all of their teams. But what we saw happen was after Title IX was passed as part of the Educational Act.
And this is in 1972.
Correct. And what's interesting is that it took many, many years for regulations to actually come down because the big concern at the time was how this was going to affect men's sports, NCAA, basically men's basketball, men's football. And, you know, we still are having that conversation today. If you look at the lawsuit and the name, image, likeness, and the paying of athletes. So that eagerness to protect those kind of big time men's sports have not changed. Interestingly, women's basketball has become big time. But, you know, the separation at all different levels is cultural, custom, and then you create rules and regulations, right? As you point out with ice skating and different things. What I think is really fascinating about these rules is that we've been talking a lot about Olympics, right? We've been talking about the top competitors. And unfortunately, that's the conversation that we have most often is, you know, the best, the champion. And yet, if we look at the deep value of sports, and we've been talking about the impact of sports on, you know, how we kind of think about ourselves, how we think about society, how we think about competence, how we think about, you know, how we get along, men, women, and, you know, as individuals. And what I would argue is that most of the sports that get played and much of the value of sport is not at that high level. It's at the, you know, kindergarten YMCA basketball, which I've coached, or soccer, or it's at the recreational league pickup games. And what I think is really kind of concerning is that when I looked at rules for some of these, you know, kind of recreational leagues like softball or basketball, they create these rules that presume that women are not as good or as competent as men. And we were doing, you know, after we wrote this book, we were, you know, going around talking, and one of the places we went was BU Law School. And in our conversations, we spoke with some students, some women there who played on recreational basketball leagues, and they were complaining to us that the way the league rules were set up was that women's baskets were worth 2 points, but men's were worth only one. So the women would be guarded much more heavily because, you know, the value of their baskets was higher. And the presumption was that, you know, the men would just be scoring at will, and the women, you know, would not score as much, so they needed to get double value for their baskets. The only problem with that was that it turned out that this woman and many of the women who are playing in that pickup league were former UConn basketball players. So the question should not be what your biological sex is. It should be, have you ever played basketball before? Same with the softball. If you look at the rules for a lot of recreational softball, there's the same kind of treatment of women as lesser or kind of disabled players. And yet, if a woman has played college softball, I would argue that that's way more advantageous than, you know, a male just because he's a male. Not everybody is physically, I mean, we have these prototypes of what we think a male athlete is and what a female athlete is. And I would argue in our, you know, in our kind of prototypical brain, we come up with the male football player and the female gymnast. And we all know from our daily experience that that is hardly the case, that physical bodies are very, very different, differently capable, differently abled. And we need to start kind of recognizing that and not creating rules that are simply meant to, you know, nail one side or the other because of their, you know, their gender.
Then let's get to the question that I think underlies a lot of the assumptions about segregation of sports. And that is that men, or those who are born male, across the board, an inherent advantage and are going to be better at any sport than a woman. Is that assumption based in fact?
What I would say is this, is that if we look at sex-based characteristics and biological sex-based characteristics, that there are certain advantages that men have, higher VO2 max, an ability to build more muscle, but there's a lot of variability as well. And there's some advantages that women have in ultra long distance swimming. Women's subcutaneous fat allow them more buoyancy and also to deal with frigid waters. Ultra long distance running, women have some advantages. The way sports are set up, the rules that are created, very often do advantage men and do glorify and hold up, you know, male physical advantages. With that said, though, that is not true at all ages and in all situations. And I mean, one of the things I looked at was a research study about ball throwing. And one of the things the researchers did is they looked at the force of throwing a ball with your dominant and non-dominant arms, males and females of different ages. These are all children, though. And what they found was that there was no sex-based differences in the force of throw before puberty. And so you see, the only difference was that as children got older, they could throw the ball harder. And yet the mythology, if you, you know, those of us who have been parents of children on the sidelines of sports, know that the presumption at every age, you know, kindergarten, first grade, I mean, is that the boys are better. There's a lot of social conditioning that goes into this. I mean, when my son played Little League, his best friend was a girl who was a fantastic pitcher and ended up playing softball in college. And I was there watching Little League games where everyone would say, oh my gosh, there's a girl on the team, as if that were some outrage. And I know that this best friend of his, that there were times when she would be rounding second and the boys who were, you know, Little League young kids would be saying, you don't belong here. You shouldn't be here. And that is a dominant cultural message that is extremely damaging and has nothing to do with actual physical differences. I mean, we can seg into conversations about transgender athletes. You know, I think it's pretty clear to say that there are differences between men who've gone through puberty and then transition and are female. There are differences. Is it always to their advantage? Depends on the sport, depends on the situation. There was an interesting thing is back in at the Hitler Olympics, there was a man who was forced by the Nazis to compete in the women's high jump as a female. He came in fourth. Now, I know that, you know, when Charlie Baker testified before Congress about transgender athletes in the NCAA, you know, he made the point there are fewer than 10 in the entire NCAA. So this, you know, going back to the role of and the intersection of politics and sport, this is something that has become highly political instead of practical. I do think there's tremendous value for transgender children in middle school and high school to being able to participate in sports. The value of sports to most people in America who have played sports as children or adults is about the sense of belonging, the sense of community, the sense of camaraderie, the sense of being part of something, of being part of a team. And I think that we are neglecting to really consider, step back and say, okay, what is the value here? You know, I remember looking at the whole question of sex testing, and women were the only ones who were sex tested. Way back when, and originally they were sex tested obnoxiously with visual inspection by IOC doctors. And under visual inspection, back in 1966, a Polish sprinter, Iwa Klobukowski, was passed on as a woman. The next year when they had chromosome tests, they said, wait a minute, you have one too many chromosomes. So this there's been a lot of confusion and effort to nail down the specific sex characteristics of an athlete. We need to think about how can we best allow everyone to compete at the level and in the situation and setting that is most appropriate for them, instead of leading this as a war on transgender athletes.
The thing that, of course, is striking is that when you're talking about elite athletes anyway, you know, whatever their sex assigned at birth, they are all pretty exceptional people, right? Of any gender, competing at that level. And as you note, the number of transgender athletes are a tiny, tiny minority. I mean, really actually underrepresented as athletes when you think of the percentage of the population at large that's transgender. So I wanted to ask you, because I know you've written about this in a different context, in the context of education in the United States, what do you feel like is driving the rights backlash against trans athletes and a particular anxiety about girls and women's sports in particular, rather than, say, men's sports?
I've watched this now for years and years, and it started very quietly as protecting girls. I mean, the same thing that we can go back to the 30s, 40s, 50s. I mean, we can go way, way back. This idea that women need to be protected, or the Little League thing, that girls need protection. So the very, I, you know, th this kind of leans back on those historical tropes about female fragility and physical inferiority. And so I think we are seeing that play out again and again and again. It fears, you know, when everyone pictures, you know, the girls being, you know, damaged, mutilated, hurt, you know. And yet, you know, what's striking is that if you look at wrestling, you know, girls wrestling has, you know, really come on in the last 20 years. And I interviewed some wrestlers early on who competed on boys' teams because there weren't girls' teams. And there were girls who were winning even state championships against boys in wrestling at the high school level. So, I mean, we have to realize that this is not really just about the facts. But for the right, this plays into all of the mythologies and beliefs about this gender logic of how things should work. I mean, the whole throwback, you know, make America great again, right? Well, you know, make America 1950s again. I mean, this plays into all of that thinking, that retro thinking that was, you know, for so many women, limiting and damaging. And I would argue that that this just is a handy kind of fear. When people don't know a lot about it, they are immediately alarmed. And without, you know, looking for a solution, the solution we should be looking for is goes back to the very foundation of what we were arguing in the book, was like, why have we set up sports this way? Is this the best way? What are we trying to accomplish here? What is the goal of sports? And I think what was really telling to me with the, you know, I want to go, return for a moment to the skeet shooting. So, you know, last year in Paris, you know, the International Shooting Sport Federation had to take up this question of trans. And they said that even though there are men's and women's divisions, they stated that, quote, gender category protections are not a concern to consider in shooting at the elite level, meaning that men and women can be equally successful. Interestingly, in the other riflery, right after they Margaret Murdoch, you know, won, and they with Liddy Vashon, and they separated the genders, the men had more shots and more events than the women. That has now been equalized. We're treating it as merely a political argument. And it's a very, you know, and it's one of these arguments that gets people in their guts because it harkens back to all the old fears about women's physical inferiority, fragility, and this kind of quote unquote, this need to protect girls and women.
I'm speaking with Laura Papano. She is the co-author of Playing with the Boys: Why Separate is Not Equal in Sports. She is a journalist and author. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, I wanted to ask you about the rise of organized sports in the United States and how it took the gendered and segregated form that it did, obviously also racially segregated. Did organized sports take the form that it did because of some natural assumption that divides sports into male and female realms? Or do you see this as something that was actually a social creation rather than that kind of conventional wisdom, you know, men and women are different, and therefore, obviously, sports must be different too.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the whole, you know, history, I mean, think of women's basketball, right? So you have, you know, the earliest women's basketball, you know, women weren't allowed to run up and down the whole court because it was considered that they physically could not handle that. I mean, there's so this belief about women's frailty has run through the history of the development of women's athletics, is that, not only was it improper for women to exert themselves, it was unwomanly, it was unseemly. And I mean, it even extends to education and studying. I mean, women were originally not allowed in higher education because it was believed that the blood for studying that the brain would require would divert it from the womb and make them barren. I mean, these are the kinds of crazy arguments that have, taken hold. And so women were constantly told that certain things would risk their reproduction. And the corollary to that was that society as a whole, and we're seeing this now in other forms, have an interest in women's reproduction and therefore should have some control over that. And that, kept women from, from athletics. And I looked at a lot of menstrual pamphlets in the Schlesinger Library because I was very curious about what's the messaging? Why do we have this separation? What's the messaging? Because it's not just girls and women being told you can't, but girls and women being told you shouldn't. And if I look at some of the menstrual pamphlets from the early eras, I mean, there are, I'm just opening the pages of the book right now and looking at some of them. I mean, you have, no better weight. Cold water gives your system a shock, so diving isn't on the don't do list if you have your period. Tennis, basketball, and other strenuous sports should be postponed. Jumping and skipping jiggle you up, so they're taboo for a few days. Getting chilled may cause trouble, so don't tumble about in the snow. I mean, the message was that girls should not exert themselves when they have their periods. I mean, what the ones I'm citing right there are from a 1940 Kotex pamphlet called As One Girl to Another. And I mean, if we look at the Boston Marathon, I mean, Bobby Gibb, put on her shorts and her brother's hooded sweatshirt, snuck into the Boston Marathon. And during the marathon, on April 19th, 1967, she was running it fine, but she was pushed off the course because it was not considered appropriate for a woman to run a marathon. We now know that that is hardly the case. So there's this notion that it's inappropriate. And I think the other thing is you brought up race, and we still have tremendous sports segregated and divided by race. And I look back at, someone like Althea Gibson, and she was a superior athlete. And yet, and people would say she was the best athlete in her community. And yet there is an inappropriateness to her play just because she was a Black female athlete. And you could see that with the Tuskegee women, the runners. They were phenomenal, and yet they took so much flack and heat for playing and running. And history is like over and over and over. What about when Annika Sorenstam, won birdied the first hole of the Colonial PGA tournament in Fort Worth in 2003, and became the first woman in 58 years to play in the event and performed exceedingly well. She made it through the first round. She didn't make the cut, but that was stunning to people. I know people were also stunned by, when we look back at, the famous Billie Jean King and Bobby Rigg, where Billie Jean King bested him. Today, we would kind of laugh at that because she was in her prime and he was an old, a much older man. But at the time, the mythology was that any man could be every woman. And that frame, I think what's so fascinating, if we talk about women's basketball again, is that we saw last year with the women's tournament, we saw obviously with Caitlin Clark, that people no longer assume that the women have an inferior product, if we're going to talk about that piece of it. I mean, if you look at last year's tournament, the NCAA finals, the final game, the attendance, we'll talk about the viewership. The viewership for the women's game drew more viewers than the men's game. They drew an average of 18.7 million viewers to the men's 14.82. First time that has ever happened. Attendance for the women's game is way up. Attendance for the men's game, you know, is fine, but the women's, the WNBA, it was this past season was the most watched regular season in 24 years for the TV and the attendance.
And so what do you attribute that to? I mean, one can look at these sort of personalities or these incredible athletes, right? The sort of generational talents that Caitlin Clark, for example, and sort of see it as the result of, you know, one or two or a handful of, you know, amazing athletes. But society generally doesn't just shift because of one or two or a handful of celebrity athletes. So when we look at the shifts that have taken place that have gotten us to this point that we're at now, given that the whole society has had its sports organized in this highly sex segregated way, with a few exceptions, which I think you say usually involve a third party like a horse, but otherwise sex segregation has structured all sports in the US. When we look at the achievements that have taken place in terms of opening space for athletes to compete together, to sort of throw off some of these strictures, how do you understand them? Or do you think they're the product of broader social movements like feminism? I mean, obviously, Title IX was a milestone, but a very complicated milestone in 1972. How do you understand it?
Well, I mean, I think we're at a very interesting time because we have a lot of indications in our society that there is a kind of, I'm going to call it a belief in equality, meaning that people fundamentally believe that, for example, women athletes are, quote unquote, worth watching. There was a period of time, I think around even when we were writing this book, where people, you know, thought it was charitable of them to watch female athletes perform. And I think that that is certainly no longer the case. And, you know, I do think Caitlin Clark, and her profile, and, you know, a whole group of other phenomenal players, Breonna Stewart and, you know, Sue. I mean, they were, you know, Sue retired, but I mean, they're a tremendous athletes. And I think it's gotten people to turn their heads and watch. And when they watch, they're like, oh my gosh, this is great competition. This is really interesting to watch. And I mean, I think we saw the same thing happen with women's tennis, right? So, you know, it used to be years ago at Wimbledon, the women, you know, in all these tournaments, women were not given the same prize purses. That's no longer true. And I think people certainly recognize that they know the names of the players. They know their style of play. They are interested in what they're in watching them compete. And I often think of it this way. I often think that it used to, you know, the argument used to be that, oh, women just aren't, you know, the game's not as fast, it's not as exciting, it's not as wonderful as the men's game. Well, if those are your standards, then why in the heck would you ever watch college football when we have the NFL? So this idea that it's biggest, fastest, strongest all the time, I think it has been an old argument that really doesn't hold water. I mean, what we see is that really talented and interesting competition between talented and athletes is very, very exciting at a variety of levels and situations, and that people are learning that. I mean, I went to the, you know, the game in Seattle at which Caitlin Clark played the Seattle Storm. There was not a seat in the arena. It was stunning because everybody wanted to see the magic of this young woman. And when we have these generational kind of athletes, they make us look at everybody else around them. I mean, Caitlin Clark was good not just because of what she herself scored, the number of baskets, but how she made all her teammates better and exciting to watch. I think that, you know, we have these old tropes weighing us down, but I do think there is a cultural engine that is underway that is recognizing the value of female athletes. And I think part of it's a lag, right? If we look at the fact that the NCAA, you know, that women just started competing in 1980 in the NCAA, right? Before it was just men, and then women had the AIAW. You know, the early concerns and the hesitation of letting women into the NCAA was that, the, you know, I have a quote from a 1975 newsletter that the annoyance of the women were, quote, living on Big Brother's credit card, that the money brought in by their sports was going to, it said, quote, finance the females and the styles to which they are accustomed. There was a lot of hostility towards any of the revenues from the so-called men's revenue-generating sports, you know, football and basketball, that was going to pay for, you know, women athletes. And it does. At many schools, it absolutely does. And also now we're getting more, you know, the women's basketball is also bringing in revenue. So, and it's not just supporting women's sports, it's supporting baseball. It's supporting men's and women's soccer. It's supporting men's wrestling. It's supporting gymnastics. It's men's and women's gymnastics. The point is that it goes back to this essential question. What is the purpose of sports on a college campus? Is it just to have a couple of superstars who are using the platform of a university, or the university using the platform of a few superstars to make money, which it certainly looks like we're headed in that direction? Or is it to create community involvement, a sense of team and camaraderie, and bring a spirit to the campus? And I think that those are the kinds of questions that we are bypassing right now when we are really just looking at these very narrow issues around gender and sport, and around sport and professionalism.
Laura Papano, let me end by asking you about the kind of reforms that you would like to see to genuinely create equality in sports. Title IX allowed for the allocation of resources for women's sports, but in many ways reinforced gender segregation in sports. What kind of reforms would you like to see to sports that would instill a genuine type of equality across the board?
First of all, just to address, I mean, Title IX was, you know, a solution at a time when people could not imagine women being legitimate athletes. And it did not equalize the allocation of dollars. It created a very complicated system for adherence to Title IX. And as a result, it's not as if you could, you know, go to a sporting event or a college or a high schooler and say they're in violation of Title IX. It's so complicated. And as a result, you have so many Title IX violations that just have been and were never addressed. So it wasn't a very good solution. And, you know, I think when I look at what we ought to be doing, I think we need to be asking many more nuanced questions. And that means that every sports kind of govern at the high levels, every sports governing federation needs to say, okay, how do we, you know, how do we make this work for the most number of people? And, you know, I think that skeet shooting observation that said, you know, we don't want to get rid of male and female categories because we want more opportunities for more people to compete. But we're not going to restrict who goes into which categories. We're not going to make a thing of it. I mean, I know that there was co-ed field hockey in New Jersey, and they were playing on turf, and they were mixed teams. Well, if you're, I played field hockey in college, and they now play on turf, the ball moves really quickly. So if you hit it too hard, that's not going to benefit you. So being stronger and hitting a harder ball are not a real benefit. In most of the world, field hockey is played by men. So I think we need to be asking questions about what is the way to organize this in the way that reaches our goals. Some of the goals at the very highest level may be to crown the most fantastic, superior athlete. In many other cases, the goal may be to create interesting, valuable competition between groups and, schools and or colleges or teams. Or at another level, it may be to be the most inclusive as possible. I know that, I play USTA tennis, and one of my teammates played against a transgender athlete, and my teammate won. I think we have to look at the rules, the structure, and what our goals are for sports, because the goals of sports should not always just be about the biggest, best, strongest winner. There's a lot that sports does in our society, and we need to be mindful of that.
Laura Pappano, thank you for coming back on the program.
Thank you. Great conversation.
Laura Pappano is a journalist and author. She's co-author with Eileen McDonough of Playing with the Boys: Why Separate is Not Equal in Sports, also the author of School Moms, Parent Activism, Partisan Politics, and the Battle for Public Education. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.